Good afternoon, members of the panel. Judge Plank, nice seeing you in court again. Richard Podol for the defendant appellant Steve Taylor, registration number 8775. Also present with me today is Dustin Preby, registration number 36850. This case involves a most unusual circumstance where a judgment has been entered against the defendant Steve Taylor in the amount of $500,000 in a case where it is acknowledged by all that he did absolutely nothing wrong, nor did he have any knowledge or notice that the Colorado licensed security broker with whom he invested was engaged in any wrongdoing. Mr. Taylor simply invested $3 million with a licensed security broker in 2006, withdrew his investment about a year later in 2007. After 3.5 years, the receiver in this case contacted him and said he was investigating claims and asked Mr. Taylor to sign a tolling agreement. The receiver did not identify the claims he was investigating. Mr. Taylor signed the tolling agreement as requested. 6 months later, in October of 2011, the receiver asserted claims solely under the Colorado Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, or CUFTA. The receiver demanded payment from Mr. Taylor of his $487,000 investment return plus prejudgment interest from 2007. The claim amounted to approximately $750,000, though Mr. Taylor's net investment return after taxes is about $300,000. CUFTA contains a time bar, which by specific terms extinguishes claims of CUFTA created which are not asserted within the time frame allowed by CUFTA. The threshold inquiry in this case is what impact did the Colorado legislature intend the time bar contained in CUFTA to have upon the right to assert the claims that were statutorily created by CUFTA? The strongest possible term that a legislative body can use to evidence its intent that a time bar destroy the right to bring the claim created by the statute, if not asserted within the time frame permitted, is a term extinguish. The genesis of this is Mid-State Horticultural versus Pennsylvania Railroad, a United States Supreme Court case that held if Congress intended a time bar contained in a statute to extinguish a claim created by the statute, the time for filing the claim could not be extended by private agreement of the parties. Mid-State has been uniformly followed everywhere. Every court that has squarely analyzed a time bar in a statute that extinguishes the claim created by the statute has held the claim is destroyed and not subject to waiver, tolling, or estoppel, cannot be revived. In 2009, a division of this court in Rossi versus Osage Highland Development discussed the intent evidenced by the Colorado legislature by the use of the term extinguished in CRS 3839207, which extinguishes any lien at such time as an underlying statute of limitation bars the underlying obligation. The Rossi court held the use of the term extinguish did not really affect the creditor's right to enforce the lien, it destroyed it. The Rossi court cited definitions of extinguish from Black's Law Dictionary to bring to an end or to terminate or cancel from Webster's Dictionary, to do away with entirely, to wipe out and destroy. The Rossi court concluded once destroyed, the lien couldn't be revived. When a statute contains a time bar that destroys a claim if not asserted within the time frame permitted, it's properly referred to as a non-claim statute. Unlike most states, Colorado jurisprudence is very clear and definitive in discussing the impact of a non-claim statute. Colorado case law, including two Supreme Court decisions authored by Justice Kirschbaum in 1987, First Interstate Bank versus Piper Aircraft Corporation, 744 P. 2nd, 1197, and Public Service Company v. Barnhill, 690 P. 2nd, 1248, have consistently held that A non-claim statute prohibits absolutely the initiation of litigation after a specific period of time. Most recently, the Colorado Supreme Court, Hall v. Hartley, 1977, Mason County Valley School District v. Kelsey, 2000, have again confirmed that a non-claim statute destroys the right to bring the claim, is a prerequisite to the assertion of the claim, and deprives the court of jurisdiction to entertain the claim if not asserted within the time frame provided by the statute. In 2009, we have the Rossi case. In 2013, the Tarco v. Confer Metropolitan District case, 2013 COA 60, have recognized that non-claim statutes destroy the substantive right to bring the claim, as well as the remedy, and are not subject to tolling, waiver, or estoppel. Now, some level of confusion exists in this area because sometimes courts refer to a non-claim statute as a statute of repose, a statute of limitations. The non-claim statute has a very specific meaning, and Colorado case law jurisprudence interpreting this is consistent with the definition in 51 Amateur, Second Limitation of Action, Section 23. Describes a non-claim statute like this. A non-claim statute creates a right that was unknown at common law and establishes a time period within which the right may be asserted, and such time limit is a substantive provision which qualifies the right. The limitation of time for commencing an action under a statute creating a new right enters into and becomes part of the action itself. It is a limitation not only of the remedy, but of the right. This section continues. Non-claim statutes are jurisdictional. A non-claim statute deprives the court of jurisdiction or the power to adjudicate a claim if it is not timely filed.
Mr. Podol, can you cite a case that says that fraudulent transfer is a statutory claim only as opposed to a common law claim?
Well, the claim created by Cuffin, it's a uniform act.
Right.
It's a Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. That specific claim is a claim that's unknown in common law. It has specific elements. It has specific defenses. It's a claim that the Colorado legislature created by statute, and a substantive element of that claim, a substantive element of the statute, is that the claim must be brought within the time frame prescribed by the statute, or it's extinguished or destroyed.
I understand that. I guess my question is, and I don't know the answer, so that's why I'm asking you. Was there no common law claim for fraudulent conveyance at all, or just no claim for fraudulent conveyance under these circumstances?
To my understanding, Your Honor, and I haven't closely looked at that question, I mean, sure, there's a common law fraud, that whole body of law, but this is a specific statutory right that's aimed at avoiding a specific transfer under specific circumstances. The transferor is insolvent, okay, and transfers whatever it is that's transferred to a transferee under circumstances that permit that specific transfer to be voided. A defense is good faith and reasonable equivalent value that I'll address in a moment. To my knowledge, there is no such claim under Colorado common law as a CUFTA claim. And a CUFTA claim is a non-claim statute. The failure to assert a claim within the time period allowed by CUFTA destroys the claim. Once the claim is destroyed, it's gone, it can't be revived by tolling, estoppel, or waiver. That's our circumstance. Simply, the receiver cannot prove a substantive element of the claim he has asserted. This isn't an unusual circumstance. Every plaintiff who brings a lawsuit is charged with the burden of proving every element of the claim, every element of the claim that plaintiff asserts. Here, the receiver can prove a substantive element of his CUFTA claim, that it was brought within the time period permitted by statute before it was extinguished and destroyed. Since the only claim asserted by the receiver is under CUFTA, and that claim has been destroyed, cannot be revived, not subject to waiver, stop, or tolling, the receiver's lawsuit must be dismissed. The second error I'd like to discuss is reasonably equivalent value. CUFTA provides a complete defense to a transferee who takes a transfer in good faith and for reasonably equivalent value. Here, Mr. Taylor's good faith is admitted. He had no way of knowing that Sean Mueller was involved in a fraud. His investment return, what had it, was for a reasonable market value. The sole question is whether he received the return of his $3 million and his $487,000 investment return for reasonably equivalent value. Now, this is a two-step analysis. The first step's obvious. He gave Sean Mueller $3 million behind that. That's exact equivalent value. The trial court, however, held that the return of the investment return on Mr. Taylor's money was not for reasonably equivalent value. The analysis of the trial court is not supported by the proper inquiry mandated by CUFTA. We've submitted uncontested expert analysis that shows, and trial court accepted it as well, the investment return received by Mr. Taylor represented a reasonable market return for the time period between the spring of 2006 and the spring of 2007. Mr. Taylor did more than just give Sean Mueller $3 million. He gave him $3 million and the use of that $3 million for a year. The use of $3 million for a year has value, maybe more in 2006 and 2007 than now, but it has value. The evidence is undisputed and demonstrates that the return Mr. Taylor received for the use of his money for a year was a reasonable market return. In other words, what Mr. Taylor got was reasonably equivalent to what he gave. The market return that he got was reasonably equivalent to the value of the use of his money for a year during that period of time. That's the appropriate inquiry under CUFTA. Now, Judge Bronfen, who worked very hard on his order and tried to do what he thought was right, acknowledged it was a problem if he did the CUFTA analysis, which is determined whether a specific transaction should be voided in light of the defense of reasonably equivalent value. Instead, he considered the fraud of the Ponzi schemer. Well, that approach, to look past the defense of reasonably equivalent value permitted under CUFTA and instead focus on the Ponzi scheme, in this case would do a great inequity. The purpose of the good faith reasonably equivalent value defense is to provide a complete immunity from a CUFTA suit to somebody who acts in good faith and gives reasonably equivalent value for what they got. If you look past that and focus on the Ponzi scheme, you get basically what's happening in this case. Mr. Taylor is asked by the receiver to give back his $300,000 debt problem, to give back his gross profit, to pay prejudgment interest on top of that. The total claim is now $840,000. Why should Mr. Taylor, who did absolutely nothing wrong, disgorge his $300,000 debt return and pay $500,000 on top of that to help reimburse other losers who had constructive knowledge, at least constructive knowledge is admitted by the receiver of the fraud? This line of winner disgorges all over investment profit cases comes from a single 1995 case, Scholes v. Lehman, written by an iconic Seventh Circuit judge, Judge Richard Posner. It was eloquently written in moralistic terms and embraced by every court around the country until the Oklahoma Supreme Court in Blair. Blair got it right. Blair said, had Scholes and all of that other authority in front of him, said, no, stop, enough. There is reasonably equivalent value in the time value of money. If you get beyond a reasonable investment return, then a clawback action is appropriate. It makes sense because that's what implicates lack of good faith, constructive knowledge, and fraud. So I better save the rest of my time, such as it is. And thank you.
Thank you.
Oh. Good afternoon. My name is Michael Gilbert, registration number 15009. With me at council table is my client, C. Randall Lewis, who is the receiver that was appointed at the request of the Securities Commissioner of the State of Colorado to act as an officer of the court to try to unwind the damage that has been wrecked by Sean Mueller's Ponzi scheme. Lost in Mr. Hodel's presentation is the fact that my client represents really a group of investors, 95 of them, who lost $72 million in this fraud. Mr. Taylor was also embroiled in the fraud. He's just got a somewhat sympathetic position. He was fraudulently induced to invest in this scheme. He put money in and he pulled money out. The money that he pulled out was paid by other investors. There's no reasonably equivalent value given for money stolen or from defrauded investors. And I'll get to that in a minute. Taylor was lucky, not so lucky, the 95 other investors that my client has been charged with the obligation to go out to try to marshal the assets of the estate to effect an equitable distribution. So this really isn't a case between two private parties. To go Mr. Taylor's way in this case and reverse an extraordinarily well-reasoned decision, I believe, by Judge Bronfen, this court has got to invalidate a tolling agreement that Mr. Taylor signed voluntarily under the advice of counsel that was signed before the expiration of the time period in CUFTA under the advice of counsel on which the receiver relied. That's the first step. Then the court's got to ignore undeviating authority under UFTA, which CUFTA is modeled after, that requires winners in a Ponzi scheme to pay back their false profits. So that's a long way to go. We believe that the right decision here is to affirm the district court. And there's one issue that we've raised on cross appeal, which is the prejudgment interest issue, which I think that the court did not award prejudgment interest in this case, but post-judgment interest. Ultimately, we'd ask that the case be remanded for a computation of the appropriate amount of that.
Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Yes.
Just to go back a minute. Do you feel that it's inappropriate to consider if a person is innocent in determining?
I don't. I think it's entirely appropriate. And we have conceded for the purposes of the papers below that Mr. Taylor didn't have knowledge of the scheme. The elements of a claim under CUFTA were under the intentional fraud claim.
Right.
And it's undisputed that these transfers were made in furtherance of an intentional fraud, a Ponzi scheme. So that's met. The question is, does he have a viable defense? Two elements of proof in that. One, he acted in good faith. Two, did he provide reasonably equivalent value for the transfers he received? That, you know, roughly speaking, is $500,000. What the cases uniformly hold is that for an equity investor, which is what this is not a debt instrument or a note or a contract rate of return, he invested in a limited partnership hedge fund that was supposed to be buying and selling securities. What he bargained for was whatever the net profits were that could be generated from that investment opportunity, or, frankly, a loss of all his principal, if that's what happened. And that is exactly what happened, is that the net assets of the hedge fund were zero, below zero. In fact, they're $70 million in the red. So if Mr. Taylor's saying, well, I have a right to a reasonable return, what's the return? What's the basis of that? There's no basis here. There's no promise to pay him anything. The receiver has essentially conceded below his good faith, and that allows him to keep his principal, the $3 million that was returned to him. Many others were not so fortunate, of course, but Mr. Taylor can keep his because he acted in good faith, and he did provide reasonably equivalent value for that $3 million. He put three in, he got three out. It's the false profits that there's no value for. There's no profit. It's money stolen from other people. And that's what all of the UFTA cases say. It starts with Shoals. It goes all the way up to the 10th Circuit recently in 2012 in Wing versus Doxedetter. The cases are uniform. The cases that Mr. Podol has cited, this Supreme Court case in Oklahoma, is an unjust enrichment case, which frankly imposes an absolutely unworkable standard for a court. It says, well, you can get a reasonable investment return. Well, what's a reasonable return from an entirely fraudulent enterprise? How does one measure that? You can't. It also proposes, you know, an unworkable standard for all of the investors. Investor A comes in and says, well, I think 20% would be reasonable for me because I was in for this period of time. I've got an expert here. He says 20% is reasonable. Mr. Taylor says, well, my 16% sort of track the market. That's reasonable. Another investor says, well, I think 40% is reasonable. A receiver is charged at the beginning of these cases with a real mess, and this court should impose a bright line rule, which has been followed by virtually every case in UFTA. It's a very clear rule. It says, if you've got false profits stolen from other people, if a Ponzi scheme exists, you have to pay them back. It gives everybody the benefit to sit down at the beginning of the case and not litigate every single claim. Any other decision, this reasonableness involves expert testimony and endless litigation. Let me address this statute, this non-claim statute argument that Mr. Podol made. This is the first time in the entire case that the words non-claim statute has come up. Below, Mr. Podol argued this was a statute of repose and that it could not be told. The district court looked at that and said, I don't have to decide that issue, and this panel doesn't either. What the court said is whether or not it's a statute of limitation or a statute of repose, it can be told and was by an express agreement that is clear and unambiguous. It says, I hereby agree to toll all statutes of limitation, all statutes of repose in between April of 2011 and December of 2011. At the time the agreement was executed, the four-year period in CUFTA had not run. The claim, according to Mr. Podol, had not been extinguished. There was nothing to resurrect. The tolling agreement itself says, if the receiver files within the tolling period, the parties agree that the date of filing of the claim will be the date of the tolling agreement before the four-year period. The statute, I don't think, is crystal clear whether it's a statute of limitation or a statute of repose. You can make arguments both ways. And there are cases that go both ways on that point. The cases, however, there's not a single case in the country that I am aware of that says the time period under CUFTA cannot be told by express agreement. There are cases out there that, in fact, go the other way. There are cases that say it can be told equitably. There are cases out there that say, and this is the SEC versus Forte case, that it can be told by express agreement. And that's what happened here. On a different statute, the First Interstate Bank case, which the district court relied on and analyzed extensively, that was a securities fraud case. There's a statute of repose in the Securities Act, the Colorado Securities Act, that said, in no event can a claim be brought more than 5 years after the securities sold. The court said that's a statute of repose. That imposes a drop-dead date beyond which a claim cannot be asserted. The statute in CUFTA is not a bright-line statute. It contains its own tolling mechanism. It says a claim shall be brought within 4 years of the transfer or within 1 year after the fraudulent nature of the transfer could reasonably have been discovered. So in the very fabric of the statute, it imposes, it builds in a tolling provision. And that's what the courts that have looked at this and said, well, you know, that's inconsistent really with the statute of repose. But what Central Bank said is, okay, even if you've got a statute of repose, I'm going to say that, you know, a panel of this court said you can toll that by express agreement unless the statute contains a jurisdictional bar, unless it's jurisdictional, which is why Mr. Podol here is arguing non-claim statute. He didn't say jurisdictional bar, but that's what central bank says. And, you know, the question here is, so is this a jurisdictional bar? There's a clear statement rule that's been adopted by the United States Supreme Court in 2012 that says if a statute's going to impose a jurisdictional bar, it has to say it clearly. Well, this statute, as the district court found, does not say it is a jurisdictional prerequisite, unlike the Governmental Immunity Act or other statutes. It has its own tolling provision that, in fact, sort of refutes that analysis.
Mr. Gilbert, okay. What bothers me the most is this word extinguished.
Yes.
That's what bothers me the most. I understand the arguments on both sides, but I don't know of any other statutory limitation provision, and we'll call it that, whether it's repose or what, that uses that language.
Well, you know, I agree, Your Honor. I mean, that's the best thing that I think that Mr. Taylor has going for us, is it's extinguished. But the claim was not extinguished as of the date of the tolling agreement. It was not extinguished as of the effective date of the filing of the claim, because the agreement between the parties says it's deemed filed before the claim is extinguished.
So, counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt. So is your argument, so long as the parties agree to extend the time period before the date, the extinguished language has no effect?
I'm saying that they can voluntarily agree to extend it. Yes. Exactly what I'm saying. I'm saying that, you know, the fabric of the statute doesn't lend itself to be interpreted as a statute of repose. But even if you do, you can voluntarily extend it. I understand the extinguished language, but I don't think that it's a jurisdictional limitation pursuant to central bank or the First Interstate Bank case.
And I was going to ask you, you said central bank before, you're talking about First Interstate
versus central bank is the case, the 1996 case by a panel of this court. And it talks about this very issue, Your Honor, to distinguish between a jurisdictional bar versus a statute of repose. I don't think you've got a slippery slope of statutes of repose. I mean, you know, a little bit of repose, a lot of repose. You've got a statute of repose, or you have a jurisdictional bar. This statute is not a jurisdictional bar.
Well, do you see any legally significant difference between the language that was being assessed in the First Interstate Bank case, the no person may sue language versus extinguishment?
I don't.
Is there some legally significant?
I don't. I think that the language in this area is loose. We've cited a couple of cases in our briefs and quoted to them. I mean, you know, this statute is adopted whole hog from UFTA. It does go back, to answer the court's question, more than 500 years, these fraudulent transfer claims, to the Statute of Elizabeth. In 1583, I believe, but I don't see a distinguishing legal principle between the two, Your Honor. And I think that, you know, when you look at central bank, one of the things it cautions, it says, well, let's look at the policy ramifications of what we're doing here. And here, those are pretty extreme. They really are. In a Ponzi scheme case, which is what we have a receiver appointed at the end of the day to try to undo the wrong. You may have 1,000 investors, you may have more, you may have hundreds, as we do in this case. The receiver takes control of the books and records and tries to sort it all out. That's what they do. And the object here was to identify winners and losers and figure out who do we need to pursue to recoup money to distribute. And we did that. And we contacted many of those investors. And most of them voluntarily entered into tolling agreements so that, number one, we didn't have to sue them for fraud, which is a tarnishment, even though it doesn't require wrongdoing. It's a fraudulent transfer claim with its ramifications. In addition, it gives people time to talk and reasonably settle matters without the necessity for lawsuits. It saves the assets of the estate, and it prevents the receiver in a case like this from having to file on the 364th day hundreds, if not thousands, of lawsuits and clogging the courts.
And
there's a case on point, Your Honors, SEC versus Forte, out of the District of Utah, in which the receiver did exactly that, and the court looked at the tolling agreements that were entered into on the 364th day after the receiver's appointment, years after the transfers, and said, the claims are preserved, which makes sense in the circumstances of this case.
when you talked about the different interests and the potential ramifications depending upon how we decide this case, do you believe those various interests that you think should be considered and balanced, that's for us to ultimately decide, or is that something that the legislature should be weighing?
Well, I think that this court should follow the central bank case. I think that that sort of decision's been made, and I think that the statute itself lends itself to tolling because of the discovery period that's built into it. I don't think it's a stretch, and I don't think it's a legislative balance. I think it's just an application of law to an existing statute. Unless the panel has any more questions, I see that my time has expired, or extinguished, as it were.
One thing that's come up, there was a supplemental authority filed.
Yes, and I am prepared to address that if you'd like.
Well, what we prefer to do rather than take time today is if you have a response to that case, if you just send a letter directed to the members of this panel individually, not more than one page, expressing your position on that particular case.
With the court's indulgence, I can give you a snapshot very quickly here, but I can also respond in writing.
Can you do it in 30 seconds?
Yes, I can.
All right, let's do it.
Okay. That involved a remedial revival statute out of Texas. The underlying court of appeals case there had said the Texas UFTA can be tolled by the remedial revival statute. The court held, well, that's a statute of repose. And the tolling statute there didn't apply to statutes of repose. It simply said statutes of limitation are remedially revived, different than Colorado statute. And it said, well, it's a statute of repose, remedial revival statute doesn't apply. That's all. It doesn't undermine the validity of my argument.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Did that last response revive 30 seconds of my time?
Mr. Poe, you filed the supplemental authority, so I don't think so.
Okay, well, thank you, Art. It was worth a try. Well, it's patently obvious from the briefing that's the argument today. The key to this case is the use of the word extinguished. It has a specific meaning. To say that it means something other than has been expressed in First Interstate, versus Piper, Mesa Valley School District, Midwest, Public Service Company, Rossi Tarco, would be going against four Supreme Court cases and several Court of Appeals cases. It's up to the legislature if the legislature wants to balance any of the public policy. The policy is expressed and embedded in the use of the word extinguished. The receiver has assiduously avoided extinguished in his brief and his argument today until the question started. And that's the gravamen of this case. There is no court anywhere, that has held that when a legislature extinguishes a claim that was statutorily created, that it can be revived, extended, waived by an agreement of the parties. Thank you. Unless there are further questions.
No such luck, Mr. Podle.
I thought I'd try again. Thank
you. Thank you both for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted. We will get you a written opinion in due course.